Our world has become complex and disruptive, and leading teams and organizations takes courage, determination, and skill. This podcast connects you to some of the great leaders to find out just how they do it. You're listening to Russell Boyce and Daryl Crook in conversation with standout leadership in a world of disruption.
Welcome to our podcast. Welcome to our listeners all over the world. And a very big welcome to our guest today, Rebecca Walk. Rebecca is the Chief Executive of New South Wales Health Infrastructure. Rebecca, lovely to be with you today. And thank you so much for joining us and joining our listeners. Perhaps, Rebecca, you might want to just start by giving us a little bit of a background on yourself and your position, and perhaps tell us about New South Wales Health Infrastructure.
Thanks, Daryl. Lovely to be here. I might just start by acknowledging the country on which I am today. I'm on the land of the Goombangia people, land which always was and always will be owned by the Aboriginal people. It's just outside of Coffs Harbour, where land, air, sea and rivers are very important. So I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present and future leaders. Daryl, who am I? It's a big question, which we all work out on the way through. I have been Chief Executive of Health Infrastructure since May of 2019. And during that time, we have seen bushfires, floods, and a pandemic. Not to mention, I'm very humbled to have the role of delivering the nation's largest health infrastructure portfolio and the second largest infrastructure portfolio in New South Wales behind transport. Originally, I am a landscape architect and was once told, what gives you the right to be a project manager if you're an urban designer and landscape architect? So I trotted off and undertook a master's of project management along the way. So that's a little bit about who I am. Country and people are very important to me. I was very blessed growing up having time in both a metropolitan area in Sydney and also in a country area in New South Wales, where I spent a lot of time on a farm growing up. So I've had, I think, the best of both worlds at being exposed to many things along the way.
Rebecca, thank you. I'd like to know a little bit more about some of the logistics of health infrastructure and invite my colleague, Russell Boyce, and my partner in crime. And Russell, I know, has a list of questions because he is just, this is one area he is so interested in, being from Canberra himself, which is smack in the middle of New South Wales. Russell.
Thanks, Daryl, and thanks, Rebecca. My goodness, you have a massive job to do, and you started just at the perfect moment for the perfect storm. That's a huge challenge as a leader, leadership in the face of disruption. Can you tease out a little bit what those disruptions look like? You mentioned bushfires, you mentioned floods and pandemics, not to mention the breadth of your professional task anyway. Can you tease out those disruptions just a little bit more, what they meant to you professionally?
Sure. I think from my background, projects are always about people, and if you get a good group of people together and you have the right culture, then it doesn't matter what the disruption is that's thrown your way. You can, through that positive culture and openness and respect, you can have great outcomes because you get positive engagement. So the bushfires were profound for me. I evacuated from my home with my children during that. So it was actually firsthand experience. And then how to assist with different responses around the state, around not only infrastructure issues, but also around how could we help. And it was one of the things which health infrastructure has a reputation for in our organisation and across the New South Wales government is we get things done. And that's by thinking outside the box. It's by having not only a can-do attitude, but it's around thinking about what's actually required and how you might achieve that by, and it always starts with positive culture and being humble about offering your help. After bushfires, we had floods, we had a few locusts in one health campus, and then we had a pandemic which lasted for what is still ongoing, but has lasted for a number of years and really changed the life for us all. And that COVID response for our organisation and for my leadership changed not only how we worked, but also how we were thought of. We weren't just builders. We were people who, a group of people who could think differently and really come to the challenge, whatever that challenge might be before us.
What's the size of that challenge, Rebecca? Throw some numbers at us. How big is health infrastructure in dollars, in capacity and size? Give our listeners a bit of an insight there, please.
We have a role in capital project delivery. We also have a role in asset management and then in the development and commercial space. The state's health assets is something in the order of $25 billion, 25. Almost 70% of the health assets are more than 30 years old. Almost 20% of them around 12 years old. So there's been an enormous investment in the last decade. It's probably slightly more, but there's still a lot more to do. At any one time, at the moment, we have around 130 projects that ranges in size from small rural ambulance stations and community health facilities, which might be being refurbished as part of a program, through to very large mega projects in precincts that are upwards of $1 billion. Our annual turnover for the last few years has generally been in the order of $2 billion. So we've sort of, as a business as usual, we can turn over about $2 billion Australian dollars. I once said to our minister, do you know how hard it is to spend that much money? So the disruptors that you questioned me about, Russell, are things like pandemics and wet weather, and how do you keep a business going in that face of adversity when people are experiencing both personal challenges around lockdowns and workforce issues, keeping smaller businesses, contracting businesses, consultancies running, subcontracting businesses, but also around the actual challenge of, is your site going to be open? Can you have meetings with the users that are going to be there? We basically pivoted as much as we could overnight, as did much of the world, into a virtual business.
Can I, that's amazing. Few moments ago, you talked about culture and thinking differently, and you've just described some of the ways in which the organisation from top to bottom has been challenged and it's responded. But essentially, you mentioned culture and diversity of thinking and the fact that you were able to continue to do that and therefore respond as an organisation to those challenges. So three questions. How did you create that culture of diverse out-of-the-box thinking in the first place? How did you nurture it? And then how did you sustain it when the world went into custard? And that's a question to you personally as a leader with the people, with the human beings, the flesh and blood.
I think it's around one of the challenges that we have is actually keeping that momentum up that you talk about. And for me, it's around humanising the workplace, putting people first, families first, believing the best in people, respecting that work is only a part of who anyone is and that everyone has other stuff going on. But it's around making sure that you are clear about what your objectives are, what roles and responsibilities are, but then celebrating the successes along the way, recognising that people need a break, experiencing burnout as we do now, and there's quite a lot written about that now, but it's really around, for me, humanising the workplace and acknowledging we're all people. It actually doesn't matter whether you're one of a global best surgeon or whether you're someone that is in a what seems like a less major role. You all have something to add to the system, and it's about respecting that. And as a leader, that's really important for me to treat everybody as though they are important and recognising that everyone is adding value, that we're all just a piece of the puzzle.
Rebecca, can I put you on the spot there a little bit? I guess one of the things our listeners might be wondering, and our listeners, Rebecca, are coming from young leaders around the world, through middle managers, through senior executives, and we've got board members listening in as well. We often hear that it's about the people and putting people first. I wonder, just catching you on the spot here, Rebecca, is there one or two particular examples in your workplace where, you know, you had some choices to make, you had some decisions to make, and you went back to that valuing of culture and people, and made your decision based very much around that?
I think there's two parts of that for me. One is always considering what the options are and looking at what the risk is associated with that, both for the system, who your clients are, but also for your business. And then inside of that, what's the risk to your people? Trust your intuition. For me, quite often you may come, and as a leader, I think I'm fairly intuitive, and then it takes a while to actually, I was going to use the word prove. It takes a while to gather the thinking around that either indicates that your intuition is correct, or that maybe you jumped the gun a bit and there's another option, which is a better option, which is less risky. But it really is about looking after people, having open lines of communication. There's no such thing as a crazy idea, but combining that with actually sound technical capability as well as behavioural competence. So it's balancing those two together for me.
So one way to think about that could be what Ronald Reagan famously said, trust but verify. I tend to deeply trust my people. I tend to deeply be sensitive to their needs as humans and their trust my intuition. I've learned over the years that it's so important to put in the verification steps as well. And you kind of touched on that a bit by making sure you've got the systems right, the competencies right.
Absolutely. And I think as a leader, when you have a level of trust in your team, you ask a casual question, and if you get an answer that gives you confidence, then you probably won't ask that question again, or at least not for some time. If you get an answer that makes you more curious, then you ask a few more curious questions, and you ask about what you can do to help. You ask about risk. You ask about what it might mean for different parts of the business. And if you get an increased level of confidence through that questioning, then you tend not to ask more questions. If you don't, then that's when, you know, as a leader, you think, well, maybe this deserves a closer scrutiny or a different peer review, or a different sort of assurance review. And I don't just mean tick a box QA. I mean how you get the confidence that the direction that you're heading is what's required of you, whether it's what your whole organisation needs, whether it's what the system needs, in our case, the health system, and if in our case, again, it's what political masters are looking for so that we meet what our performance indicators are. I've not ever been likened to Ronald Reagan before, though, Russell.
Yeah, I seem to recall when Reagan said that, Russell, he was referring to some of members of the Russian community. The irony, as I recall, is he was quoting something very similar said by Stalin some decades earlier. So there's certainly some irony as a historian, I think, looking back at that. Rebecca, you talked about several masters just then. And on a previous podcast, Russell and I were talking to a leader about some of the differences between leading in the private enterprise, where it's fairly clear cut. You have a board, and the board tells you what to do, and the board makes a decision, and the CEO makes a decision, and that's pretty much it. In the public sector, as I understand, Rebecca, you report through to the minister, but you also have an advisory board and lots of other interesting stakeholders in the political landscape. Can you tell us a little bit about how you navigate through those delicate pathways of multiple stakeholders?
It's hard to go wrong with the truth, Darryl, but it's around how you present that truth and what level of detail that you present in any picture, I think. I think it's around understanding what your mandate is in any space, and it could be completely different in different spaces. If I am chairing a steering committee meeting, the mandate for me personally is quite different than if I'm briefing our Minister of Health and the Premier or Deputy Premier or Treasurer. It's you pitch it at a different level. It's also around understanding what the governance framework is when you are able to make a decision and when you're not. It's around working with your team so that everyone is respectful to what that governance level is. If you're at a working group, it's around generating ideas, being innovative, inspirational. There's no such thing as a crazy idea. It's when you want that way out there thinking. As you then move forward different levels of governance, you're looking at different levels of risk and what the risk appetite is, and then you get to a, you know, depending on what the decision is, different levels of decision making. So I think for me it's around understanding mandate and understanding that governance framework and always being respectful of that.
You said it's always or it's hard to go wrong with the truth, and I fully endorse that. But I'm wondering, or again, I know from experience, sometimes you've got to say to the people who are grappling with the problems, and you're trying to grapple with the problem with them, look, I just don't know. I don't know how to handle this. Let's figure this out together. Other times there might be situations where you've got to put on more of a brave front, and it's almost almost acting. You're maintaining truth, but you're not. You've got to carefully manage the morale, the whole way in which a situation is unfolding. There are seasons. One of you could have you had any experience of that sort of contrast?
I sometimes tell my executive team that I will share with them as much information as I can, and that is appropriate at any time. And I think as an individual and a person, I probably share more than some other styles of leaders do. It's so that my team can have a really true understanding of the delicacies sometimes, or the appetite which is out there in different circumstances. But there are occasions when they know that if I ring and say I need an answer and I need, you know, we need to get a response together reasonably swiftly, and we'll explain it later. I think there is an appreciation among emerging leaders and upper levels of management and executive that sometimes you don't understand the framework in which someone above you is operating, in that I use the word hierarchy, but it's more around different levels of questioning at different times in different spaces. And it's not helpful for me to expose my whole team or the organisation to what might be uncomfortable questioning or things which are a risk in different circumstances depending on the landscape, whether it's the political landscape or whether it's something which could have an outcome which isn't necessarily positive at that time. It's really about then understanding what is an appropriate level of detail. So, you know, sometimes your team has to trust you as much as you trust them that you are asking a question, because you need to know the answer. And the chief executive really has the right to ask any question of their own organisation. It's then how they ask that question, and to make sure that they do it respectfully, and then to give as much information as is appropriate, but not drown someone so that they go home worried about something and they don't know the full context. And if they did know the context, they'd either be a lot more worried, or alternatively, they might be a lot less worried depending on what the topic is.
So what's the biggest thing that you would do that develops in your team trust in you to manage, so that they will go with you on those situations and trust you?
Always have their back, always support them, never hang them out to dry. It's okay to make a mistake. but let's work out how to solve that mistake together rather than not admitting that you've made a mistake. So I think it's building trust over time so that you are then working in an environment where you do bounce things off each other, and sometimes you do share things which are uncomfortable, but you know that you have each other's back, but that I will always have the back of everyone in my team, even if that's at personal expense to me.
I hear a touch of that authenticity and perhaps vulnerability coming through there as a leader. And our listeners often, I assume, are asking themselves questions around how do you develop leadership? And I know myself as an executive coach over the years, people have said, well, have you got to go and do an MBA? You know, have you got to read a lot of leadership books? You know, have you got to get a degree in leadership if that exists? I'm interested, Rebecca, just for you to tell our listeners a little bit about maybe your leadership learning and your leadership journey. We've been listening to you now talking about some of the really delicate and important issues of senior executive world. That didn't just come to you. You must have developed that over the years. Tell us a little bit around how did you learn leadership? How did you develop the skills that you have these days as a CE?
I can start by saying I'm not sure I know the answer to that, Darrell. It is a journey. I think it is. I spent time growing up on a farm where you didn't have a choice necessarily about how to solve a problem. So you learned how to think. You either did what you were told by way of tasks, so relatively task-oriented, but you were innovative in how you might have achieved that task. I then chose as a young professional a career in something which there weren't many women in. 30-plus years ago, women in construction site offices were still the brunt of jokes. I was very fortunate in that I worked with a number of middle-aged professionals who wanted to give me a go, who demanded respect from other people around me, and who taught me what they learned. Not all of that was positive for me as a learning process, and sometimes you learn how to be a good leader by looking at what's not good to do. So you look at the flip side and say, well, that doesn't feel great, or that doesn't look good. So you say, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try this over here. I think it's around honouring meritorious appointments. So, yes, I was a young woman in construction, trained then in project management. I grew up in a family with a can-do attitude. So a fair amount of diversity in that space, a certain amount of unpredictability too, I guess. But it was around you have a job, you're good at what you do, you get that job because you are good at what you do, because of hard work, not simply because I was a young woman in a man's world. So I think that's part of my learning as a leader, that you will go places because of who you are and because of how you do it, and then the rest follows through. And if that doesn't follow through, then quite frankly, it's not a place I want to be. So if you are working in an environment where there is that respect and there is that diversity of thinking, then that creates an environment where you can develop your own leadership style and you can lead by example. And I think I may not be some things, but I am authentic in I lead by example. I don't ask anyone to do what I'm not prepared to do myself.
Rebecca, you touched there on the construction industry, and I can almost see many listeners around the world sort of nodding sagely, the construction industry. And there are a number of those similar type of industries, be it mining or otherwise, which your term, a man's world, and it has been that for generations. How hard was it? There are many young female leaders listening to you right now. How hard was that? What were some of the key learnings? What were some of the hard learnings that you had along that journey?
There will always be occasions when things don't work out the way you think they will. You can't choose what's thrown your way. You can choose how you respond to it, whether that's in your personal life or your work life. It's how you balance those things. It's how you, in a not a dogmatic way, but how you live by your own standards. For me, it's really around knowing what you stand for. And at this stage, Daryl, I've completely forgotten the question you asked me.
Thank you for your honesty. It's some of those hard learnings along the way. Yeah, particularly focusing for this question, Rebecca, around a young female as you were then in a man's world as it was then and sadly still is to some degree. And some of those hard learnings to be able to gain that respect through, and you were hinting at meritocracy there, on merit rather than on gender, rather than on age, rather than on all the other issues that we understand these days around diversity and inclusion, but on merit. Tell us, you know, were there a couple of defining moments for you in your leadership journey?
I think it's gain respect for the inputs that you can have and that you do have. So it's, you know, there were times in meetings and potentially still are where you are thought to be the person in the room that's taking the minutes. It's around, even if you are taking the minutes or taking notes, it's around making helpful suggestions, being noticed for what you can add to a conversation. And then people start to ask for your opinion, not so it's about putting yourself in a position where you are able to add value, choosing those moments where you can add value, volunteering for things, not where it means that you are working harder than anybody else, but putting yourself out there, whether it's being involved in a committee where you can add more value or think differently. It's around just doing, and I think regardless of whether you're a young man or a young woman professional, it's around creating opportunities for yourself where you can then leverage your skills and be noticed. And I was, you know, very fortunate to be given some opportunities, and I took them unashamedly. I took them and was offered from one position to another position. You might apply for a job where you think you don't have a chance of getting it, but then you may get an interview, and if you get an interview, you can put your best foot forward, and you may not be successful in every role, but you will be successful at some stage, and then you can continue to show what value that you can add. You can be true to yourself and true to your profession, but again, you have to have that balance of being technically competent and behaviourally competent, and if you... You can have the best technical people in your business, but unless they are culturally behaving in accordance with the values of your business, it doesn't matter. And I say in my business, great if you're technically competent, but unless you are also behaviourally competent, you are not welcome in my business. And we have had some hard conversations and some hard discussions about succession planning. We know we have skills shortages, particularly in construction industry. We know that we need to have better traineeships, better cadetships, better graduate programs. None of that, notwithstanding any of that, it's still not okay just to be technically, you know, the best engineer or the best construction manager in Australia. Unless you treat people the right way, you're not welcome in my business because your projects suffer. You don't have good outcomes.
So, Rebecca, we could go in so many directions at this point, but let's keep talking about that for a moment because that's so important. One of the things that Daryl and I have talked to quite a lot of people recently about is the fact that there are so many STEM capable or talented organizations and their train wrecks when it comes to the culture, when it comes to the behavioral aspects. My belief is that we need to start young. We need to be focusing on our future leaders who today are the youngsters, even the secondary school kids or even the primary school kids. How could we reach those kids, possibly getting alongside their teachers, but how could we grow those soft skills, those leadership attributes in the kids who will be the future technical stars?
I think, again, it's about diversity of thinking. So it's, you talk about big construction companies and mining companies where there's a big churn and burnout rate. It's about getting some people in those businesses that aren't just STEM-based. And I've said at different construction industry events where we've been promoting a 5-day working week, not a 6-day working week, or a flexible work arrangement. If you say to a group of people, even if they are predominantly men in construction, is this an industry you want your daughters to be a part of? They may say no way. And then if you ask them why, you can start to dig into what needs to be different. It needs to be respectful. It needs to be, part of it is having different technology, having digital skills. We need to actually respond to the youth of the future and what they're interested in. They don't want to work the same way that I did when I was in my 20s. Technology is different now. They want more agility and flexibility in their ways of working. They want to be able to work some of the time virtually. They want it to be fun. They want to be able to have fun at work. Sometimes they want you to provide them lunch or breakfast or whatever it might be. It's around thinking about what's going to make it fun for those people, so that a bunch of 4-year-olds in a room don't all just want to be nurses and policemen when they grow up.
Really, really well said there. I can see so many listeners around the world just nodding and smiling and saying, yes, absolutely. And we need to have that conversation across not just the construction industry, but across all sectors. I also like the way you talk about diversity, Rebecca. Often people will say, oh, well, you mean gender, or you mean cultural differences. And yet there are so many different types. You've touched on thinking styles there, diversity of thinking styles. You've touched on diversity of qualifications and backgrounds coming to the table, bringing their different skill sets and mindsets to the table. How are you managing that from a leadership point of view across New South Wales health infrastructure? What value can you bring there from your position?
We don't, just immediately prior to the first COVID lockdown, we trialled an agile learning platform where it became acceptable for people to work from home. We announced that that was no longer a pilot, but was our business as usual, coincidentally, a week before we went into lockdown. That meant we went from a paper-based finance department where all of our finance folk came in, ploughed through mountains of paper invoices for data entry into a completely digital world. And those people now welcome coming back to a mixed working environment where they are in the office sometimes, they work from home sometimes. It means they can fulfill their other responsibilities around family and friends, around other commitments they have, whether it's with aging parents, young children, sports commitments, or other things that they do in life. It's around providing some flexibility and agility in that space. What else can we do? It's around, again, sponsoring the touch footy teams so that people of all different diversities can get together every now and then and just have fun, and for it to be healthy fun. It's not just going to the pub and having a beer after work. It's around different ways of engaging, different ways of understanding who people are that you work with, what their needs are, about then creating an environment where if someone's not okay, they might actually reach out and tell you that they're not okay or that they need help, that they can't get that done this week, that what you're asking them to do is unreasonable. for their particular circumstances at that particular time. So I think it's around creating that environment where you have a different platform of understanding and for it to be okay to be you.
So Rebecca, you went from everybody at work and many of your divisions paper-based to online being business as usual, which I guess doesn't mean that everybody was online, but that represents digital transformation. However, and that's where the world's going. That's the future of work. But digital transformation is not, it's not really about turning paper into electrons. It's about bringing digital technology to bear so that decisions can be made more readily, so that the organisation can get its job done more efficiently, so that the way in which the people work and operate is enhanced, greater outcomes all over the place, leading an organisation through that process so that you actually achieve that digital transformation in all of the fullness that it can be that can be realised. That's challenging. Have you experienced that? How did the organisation react to that? Some, it sounds like some reacted very positively, others perhaps not.
I think, depending on people's own personal circumstances, being in a digital world is much more difficult for some people around issues of isolation, around that feeling that you have to be constantly available. If someone sends you an email at night, you have to respond at night. It's about recognising that different people work at different times and how that might be. I think in the health space, it's sent us or allowed a trajectory of acceleration around things like telehealth. Now, people are more interested in what their healthcare looks like. They are not so accepting anymore of the doctor says this, therefore it's what I have to do. They go and do their own research. They want to be involved. You know, they may have an app on their watch, collecting data on their watch that sends it to an app that does, can then send information to whatever their specialist might be, whether it's their cardiologist, to look at what their heart rate was doing. It's around providing different environments that then allows different ways of thinking to accept data. So in that case, it's for people to have more virtual healthcare. They may have to go to an initial consultation in a hospital or clinical setting, but then their follow-up consultations they may be able to do from home, which in certainly in parts of rural Australia means saving enormous cost, sustainability cost, energy in having to travel to appointments. So there have been all sorts of unexpected advantages which we are now harnessing, and that is around a longer term strategy of how healthcare needs to develop around digital innovation. I don't know what I don't know. My kids in late primary school don't know what a BlackBerry is, you know, what was a fax machine, let alone, you know, what's the curly thing that comes off the wall that used to be a telephone. Like, things are traveling with such rapidity that we don't know what we don't know, but we have to think in a way that tries to provide an openness of future-proofing so that we can, in our infrastructure space, retrofit so that we can redesign. And part of that, I think, is around co-design, about what expectations are, community expectations, clinician expectations, so that we can harness partners in research and education to then say, what should we be doing now for the future? And I think all of us as citizens are seeing that in the sustainability space. We all know we want to be more sustainable. We all know there's a problem, but we're not quite sure what we need to do next.
What about your team and your organisation at large? If they're, during lockdown, for example, working together digitally but separated physically, the intangible connections that build culture in ways that are hard to describe, were they lost? And if so, how do you regain them or how do you compensate for them, or is that a risk for the future?
We did things like had a catch-up with your team, with a broader team, once a week, once a fortnight. They, we turned social engagements team catch-ups into people's living rooms. We met each other's kids. We didn't mind that someone was photobombed with a toddler needing something urgently from a parent working from home. So I think we found different ways to stay connected and in many ways to learn more about each other in that space. You know, it's great. I still turn up at meetings sometimes and say, I've never met you other than on a Teams meeting. I didn't realise you were tall. I didn't realise you were short, you know, whatever it might have been. You get a surprise when you meet someone. It's that we've only ever met on a computer screen. It sometimes drives efficiency because you can cram a lot more in. The downside of that is you don't have enough time between meetings, thinking time. You don't have enough space to decompress. So it's really important around the wellbeing space. And we have developed in our business a lot stronger focus around not only workplace health and safety in the traditional way for construction, you know, about not being physically harmed in the workplace, but also around wellbeing and what wellbeing looks like and what initiatives we need to do and to be constantly challenging ourselves in that space.
Rebecca, on that wellbeing issue, I heard you say earlier about moving the sector, moving the construction industry from a six-day week to a five-day week. That sounds like an enormous change, an enormous value add there. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit more about how that came about, what your role is, why you see that as so important?
We started to ask industry for different suggestions about how we can structurally change the industry to be a better workplace, because that's about not only training new people in the workplace, but retention of skilled people. And one of the ideas that came back was to have a five-day working week. So that means, and we engaged jointly with our construction partner in that space and with a university around doing a piece of research around interviewing, looking at what efficiencies happened or inefficiencies, what happened to program, what happened to cost, and also what happened to families and to people. And there is some very positive outcomes around, you know, parents who got to go to soccer games on Saturday, get to do things with their families. They still effectively work the same number of hours or got the same productivity, but in 5 days, not 6 days. We are now finding that they're on many of our projects, there is no time or cost penalty in adopting a five-day week. So I'm confident that over time it will become the norm. It doesn't suit every project. Sometimes there are time imperatives that mean that you have to keep moving for shorter periods. And in certain industries, I guess it doesn't mean the same either. The industries that I'm not involved in where you have to keep machinery running 24/7. But for us, it's not necessarily a five-day week, but that was a tremendous example. And we are consistently challenging our industry partners around how do we collaborate to come up with different ideas to have better places to work, where people want to work and where people want to stay working in that industry, and when we can attract other people to industry. And we did bring in that pilot project, that first project. It was successful, and it did open on time and within budget and during COVID.
So, Rebecca, the last word from you, what would your advice be if you had one take-home message to give to those young leaders today who are grappling with the disruptions that they face with increasing frequency? What's the best piece of advice you could give to them?
Give it a go. You know, it's a great Aussie thing to do, to have a go. But I think it really is, you know, back yourself, back the people around you, acknowledge that it won't always work, that sometimes you know, a few steps forward and a couple back, but really believe in yourself and the people around you, treat people with respect, treat all the simple things, treat other people the way you'd like to be treated yourself, think outside the box, and look at what all those options are, what's best for business, what's best for your people. Because really, if you respect people, You will have a positive culture, and through positive culture, you get great engagement. And through great engagement, we can have fantastic outcomes.
Rebecca Walker, it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you today, and our listeners globally, thank you for your time. They thank you for your insight, the insight that you have given us over the last 45 minutes or so has been quite remarkable. Thank you so much again. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Darrell, and thanks, Russell.